There's a time and a place for a fillet of fish. But breakfast is for sausage biscuits. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
I welcome Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, taking us back to that moment when the Iraq War went sideways, 2003-2004, and lessons learned. Why? Because much of the attention right now on Ukraine is about a war that describes something like Iraq, like Vietnam, like all the other small wars that the U.S. has involved itself with since the big one, the struggle in the First and Second War against European powers. However, Anatole, a very good evening to you. I read your foreign policy piece, and I look for lessons learned because of the complete domination of the U.S.'s military on the planet Earth. And yet, in my lifetime, in our lifetime, we've seen repeatedly that great big military machine crash and fail against small states. Is there one or several reasons we can identify for that? Why is it that we do so poorly on the small scale and have such a great reputation on the big scale? There hasn't been another big war since 45. Good evening to you.
Hello, John. Well, I mean, I have a geopolitical principle, which, if I may say modestly, I codified myself, which is to say that all geopolitical and but most especially military power is not absolute, it's local and it's relative. That is to say, it is the power that one country is able but also willing to bring to bear in a place or on an issue compared to the power that another state or states is willing and able to bring to bear. And therefore, you know, locality matters enormously. In a war on the world's oceans, the US and its allies would win hands down. Any war that, as the Second World War did, which began with an attack on the United States, the US public would rally totally behind the war effort and would be willing to support whatever efforts and whatever policies were needed to win. But of course, when you get involved in local conflicts, you find that regional states, because they are regional states, they live there, they have vital interests involved, which the US does not. They have both the means of influence, but also the will to do more than the US in their own backyard. And so you have the very strange effect. I mean, nobody thinks of Pakistan as a superpower, but Pakistan turned out to be in many ways more powerful than America in southern and eastern Afghanistan. Iran, in many ways, is more powerful than the United States in Iraq and Syria. But there is another factor now, which has been really dramatized by the war in Ukraine, and especially what's happened to the Russian Black Sea Fleet. The Russian fleet was assumed to be, that it, in any war, it was going to be absolutely dominant in the Black Sea, because Ukraine has hardly any ships at all. It hasn't turned out that way, because using cheap drones, both airborne and seaborne, and missiles, the Ukrainians have been able to cripple the Russian Navy. Now, the Ukrainians couldn't do that to the Russians in the Arctic, obviously, or the Russians in the Pacific, but they can do it on their own littoral. Now, this is a very, or ought to be a very frightening lesson for America, though also in a way reassuring, because the Chinese cannot possibly challenge, you know, America's global naval dominance. There's no chance of the Chinese being able to convoy, you know, Chinese oil tankers from the Persian Gulf across the Indian Ocean. So in a global naval war, the US wins. But of course, in a war over Taiwan, close to China's shores, fighting a China which can produce, to all intents and purposes, limitless numbers of cheap drones, That is a very different matter, or, well, would be, but pray God it doesn't happen.
I'm immediately drawn to the Vietnam example with your recommendation, because what you just said explains the frustration there over many years. The challenge was to seal the border of the Ho Chi Minh Trail from the north, and that chiefly was the part of the country known as I Corps, the northern part. And though the U.S. sent wave after wave of sophisticated bomber and air attacks and all kinds of platforms and poured Agent Orange and all kinds of munitions into I Corps, they could not conquer it. The North Vietnamese kept supplying the Viet Cong, and eventually it wore down the U.S. to the point of political withdrawal and then overrunning the country. Your lesson applies perfectly to Vietnam, which recommends to me to ask, since you've seen this over many years, why hasn't the Pentagon learned that lesson, that they cannot beat local?
Well, I think a disastrous moment was, you know, what's been called the Wolfowitz Doctrine of 92, when in that moment of, you know, extreme hubris after victory in the Cold War over the Soviet Union and the disintegration of the Soviet Union itself, many Americans really did think that they could do anything anywhere in the world, and said that explicitly. I've heard that over the years from both Republican and Democratic foreign policy thinkers. And Wolfowitz, you may remember, mandated that the U.S. should be the hegemon, should exert primacy, not just on the world stage as a whole, but in every region of the world. And no other country should have any influence beyond its borders, beyond that which was allowed to it by the United States and was in accordance with U.S. interests. Well, I mean, it was pointed out at the time, this is a megalomaniac approach to the world, which was bound to be opposed by a whole range of countries, China, obviously, India, Russia, if it recovered. But unfortunately, although, as I say, when it was leaked, it was so condemned at the time, this has to a degree become the standard operating procedure of every succeeding U.S. administration, with, you know, small wobbles under Obama. And it's not sustainable. You know, you compete with countries on the world stage, you win. You compete with them in their own backyard. Very different matter. Long before America became a global superpower, the other European countries knew that they couldn't challenge America in its own backyard, because there, America was more powerful than they were.
Observing this now, let's apply it to Ukraine. The U.S. has just vouchsafed pouring billions of dollars of new weaponry into Ukraine. At the same time, there's always that hesitation. Don't push us into a wider war. Sometimes it's talked about as a nuclear war. Don't do this, don't do that. Is that suggesting that the U.S. has learned a lesson? Because we do not see elements of the 82nd Airborne in Kyiv. Have we learned from that not to do it again?
Well, I think to a degree. But of course, as you say, nuclear weapons play a tremendously important part, because any shooting war with Russia obviously involves the very, very serious risk that it will escalate to nuclear war. And then people do think, you know, do start having to think, is it worth risking, you know, the destruction of the United States and of modern civilization for a question of who rules Eastern Ukraine? And, you know, rendered in those terms, the answer is obvious. But also, of course, even a war that did not escalate to nuclear war would require the United States to deploy in order to win reasonably quickly and at low cost the greater part of its air force to Europe to defeat the Russians. It would require the U.S. Navy to impose a naval blockade on all Russian maritime trade. Well, you can just imagine the opportunity that would present to China and to Iran. Unfortunately, I mean, much of U.S. Policy over the past generation has, really driven all the potential rivals of America together, which means that one really serious crisis in one part of the world is very likely to spread to another.
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. We've been looking at lessons learned or not learned yet about the conduct of the U.S. foreign policy since the Second War in small wars. When we come back, the small war of Ukraine, is there another path forward? Is there a way to negotiate, and is there a model of that negotiation? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Battle.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.